We've been waiting for you. Come on in. It's Talk 10 Tuesday with Chuck Buck and Dr. Erica Raymer for April 30th, 2024. Today, we welcome Matt Bridge to explain why it's out with the old and in with the new. New way to improve patient access. We'll get the latest coding news from Gloria Ann Bryant. Tiffany Ferguson covers the social determinants of health. Tim Powell is at the Tuesday news desk, and Dr. Raymer presents her talkback segment. Now here's the publisher of ICD-10 Monitor, the host of Talk 10 Tuesday, and a man who's terrific at thinking outside the box, but wishes someone would invite him in, Chuck Buck.
Let me in. Thanks, Clark Anthony. Hello, everybody. And welcome to the 596th live edition of Talk 10 Tuesday in your morning, Erica.
Good morning, Chuck, and welcome back to most of you. We still don't see you, but we understand you'll be back in full view next week.
That's right, full view, yeah. Hey, listen, as you heard Clark Anthony announce, senior healthcare consultant Matt Bridge is with us today. He's going to be reporting on how hospitals can improve patient access by, using new systems and tossing out the old one, just like out with the old and in with the new. So what's your reaction to all of that, Erica?
Well, as long as the new helps us take better care of patients, I am all for it.
Yeah, very good. So, Erica, what's the topic for your talk back today?
I still have a few questions I'd like to answer from the NPAC session I gave.
Oh, good, good. Excellent. We look forward to hearing your talk back. And, folks, we have a lot of news reports, so we're going to begin this morning with Tim Powell. Tim is at the Talk 10 Tuesday news desk.
Hi, Chuck, and I'm going to talk about the challenges of sustaining nursing home care amid new regulations and changing finances. In 2019, the nursing home industry was relatively stable, generating $126 billion in net revenue and a profit margin of around 9%. However, recent financial reports indicate a drastic shift in the sector's financial health. Latest data shows that for 2022 Medicare cost reports, for 10,354 nursing homes, they showed a gross revenue of $129 billion, but a net loss of $2.6 billion. This stark contrast raises significant concerns about the financial viability of nursing homes, especially in light of new federal regulations aimed at improving quality. The financial situation of nursing homes has seen a rapid shift in recent years, partly due to inflation and changing economic conditions. Inflation has affected every sector of the economy, including healthcare. Rising costs for supplies and utilities and staffing have significantly impacted the budgets of nursing homes. The increased cost of operations, coupled with declining revenues, left many facilities struggling to stay afloat. Additionally, the COVID-19 pandemic has had a special impact on the nursing home industry. The pandemic brought increased costs for personal protective equipment and testing and staffing. It also led to a decline in occupancy rates as families chose to keep their elderly loved ones at home or tragic losses occurred among residents. These factors have further strained the financial resources of nursing homes. Amid this challenging financial climate, a new regulation has been introduced that requires facilities to maintain a minimum of 3.48 hours per resident day of direct nursing care, of which at least 0.55 must be provided by registered nurses or RNs and 2.45 by nurses' aides. While this regulation aims to improve the quality of care for residents, it also presents a significant challenge for nursing home operators. Staffing costs are a major portion of a nursing home's budget, and the new regulation necessitates a higher staffing level, particularly of RNs and nursing aides, which could lead to an increased labor cost in a sector already struggling with financial difficulties. Absorbing these additional costs may prove challenging. The crux of the issue lies in balancing the need for high-quality care with financial stability. The new regulation emphasizes the importance of direct care staff in ensuring nurses and residents receive the care that they need, but implementing these standards may be untenable for many facilities without additional funding or support. To address this issue, policymakers must consider ways to support the nursing home sector financially. This could involve increased Medicaid and Medicare reimbursement grants or rates and subsidies aimed at helping facilities meet the new standards. Additionally, encouraging innovative solutions such as telehealth services or partnerships with other healthcare providers could help reduce costs and improve delivery. So in conclusion, the financial health of the nursing home industry has taken a significant hit in recent years, from a stable revenue stream in 2019 to a net loss in 2022. The new regulation requiring increased nursing care hours further challenges the sector's sustainability. For nursing homes to survive and continue providing quality care to their residents, a multifaceted approach is needed, And this approach should balance the need for high quality care with financial stability through measures such as increased funding and innovative solutions and potential regulatory adjustments. In the end, the goal is to ensure that nursing homes can continue to offer essential services to the aging population while maintaining their financial health. And with that, back to you, Chuck.
Wow. Thanks, Tim, very much. That was Tim Powell. Tim is a compliance expert, and he's the national correspondent for ICD-10 Monitor. Folks, it is Tuesday. It's April the 30th, and you're listening to the 596th live edition of Tucked In Tuesday.
In the ever-changing, ever-evolving landscape of healthcare, deciphering the intricacies of coding social determinants of health poses a significant challenge for medical professionals. The introduction of new codes in 2024 has left many providers grappling with the integration of these, as well as the new care management codes, into outpatient physician practices. But here's good news. There's a webcast on understanding how the new social determinants of health assessments translate into coding opportunities. Join senior healthcare consultant Tiffany Ferguson as she explains how to incorporate the social determinants of health screening tool results directly into coding responses in adult and pediatric populations. The webcast, 2024 SDOH Update, Navigating Coding and Screening Assessment, is on May 21st at 1:30 p.m. Eastern. Register now to attend at the ICD University Bookstore.
Now's the time for the Tucked In Tuesday Coding Report with senior healthcare consultant Glorianne Bryant. Glorianne is substituting today for Lori Johnson. And good morning, Glorianne.
Good morning, Chuck, and good morning, everyone. When I say the number 19.7, what do you think of? Well, a recent study from healthcare solutions company Premier indicated that $19.7 billion is what hospital and healthcare systems are spending on handling and appealing denials. Yes, that is billions with a B. There are several categories or reasons why a payer claim is denied, and these can occur, but not limited to medical necessity, claim edits, pre-authorization, and others. There's two buckets or reasons that I work in that I've really seen increased in hospital denials. These were hospital inpatient denials. And those two buckets are clinically invalid diagnosis or clinically invalid and due to coding errors from inconsistent documentation. And I emphasize inconsistent documentation. And as you can tell, both of these are about clinical documentation at the core. Oftentimes, we see payers using their own clinical criteria or their own interpretation of coding guidelines to support a diagnosis denial. Granted, mistakes do occur, and they must be corrected in a timely manner once identified. We all know that, and we should be adhering to that. But what I'm focusing on here is the ongoing payer denials that look into a clinical documentation and coding of a given diagnosis for inconsistencies. To ensure that accurate and consistency is there in the medical record, it does take detailed and specific documentation by and from the care team, especially the providers. For hospital inpatient admissions, we see them coming through the emergency room most often. So we're expected to see the ED provider documentation correlate somewhat to the admitting HMP documentation and findings and impression. But we also expect to see something in that initial progress note that correlates to the HMP and the ED. And then we would expect that a consultant, if they're called in, some of this correlates too. So it's building a story and it all is kind of linked together. Ultimately, we see the patient being discharged and they have a payer discharge summary. That documentation on that discharge summary is one of the areas that I see kind of a focus for lack of consistency or inconsistency. There may be documentation missing and it creates a gap in determining the accuracy of the ICD-10 CM code that's being assigned. And if we look at this one issue a little further, we see that ongoing practice from payers to deny a principal diagnosis or even a secondary diagnosis for an inpatient admission, that because it's not listed or included in the discharge summary or the final progress note, even if it's documented, by the ED. It's documented in the H&P. It's even documented in the first initial progress notes, except within the final progress note. And then the payer will then request the ICD-10 code that was assigned to and submitted to be removed from the claim, removed from the record. And removal of a particular diagnosis is one of the impacts, certainly on payment. That's the crux of this. And of course, it does impact, in my mind, data integrity and a true data picture of the encounter and how and what went on with that patient. That diagnosis helps tell the story. Now, appealing these types of common sick situations is what hospitals do in healthcare systems. And you heard those dollars at the very beginning. I was talking about the $19.7 billion. So appealing happens, appealing once, appealing maybe twice, appealing a third time even or more. This is all very, very time consuming and costly and labor intensive. The ICD-10 diagnosis codes are coming from the documentation in which the coding professional makes the determination that that condition diagnosis is supported and it flows and is compliant with the official guidelines and even with AHA coding clinic guidance that may occur. That coding professional is striving for accuracy. They are striving for a true representation and picture of the patient encounter. And yes, the whole record must support the code that is assigned. In fact, the official coding guidelines for coding and reporting state that the entire record should be reviewed to determine the specific reason for the encounter and the conditions that were treated. It says that the entire record has to be used. So this guideline doesn't say you have to have it in the principal, you have to have it in a final progress note. I mean, that is ideal, and I agree that is a best practice to correlate the whole story all the way through. But if the whole record is utilized, isn't that code then justified? And yes, isn't it truly reflecting what went on? Or is this truly all a conflict, inconsistent documentation, and there should be a query sent to the provider to clarify that and include it in the discharge summary? But does this lack of having the diagnosis in a discharge summary really result that the rest of the record is basically not counted for the determination of a diagnosis? And does each and every provider then have to go through the record and state the diagnosis every single time that they make a notation electronically in the record in the EHR? Or does the whole record stand as evidence for a given diagnosis? Those are good questions to ask. So what do we do with payer denials regarding these situations of inconsistency? If you really believe strongly that the whole record represents that diagnosis, well, yeah, you should appeal that and write up an appeal letter for that. You could also reach out to payers and your contracting leadership. Request a discussion. Come to the table about these situations and how in our agreement contracting language, we can fit in these scenarios and fit in that they will always follow official guidelines for coding and reporting. Now, taking those steps initially are great. And I have some other suggestions in my article that was posted today. But start off by working on these types of denials. And if you feel your whole record represents that condition, then you should be appealing. Reach out and communicate is ideal. And I hope that helps you think about some things today. Now back to you, Erica.
Thanks, Gloria Ann. I'm working on a project right now where I'm dealing with clinical validation, and it's frustrating because sometimes the record actually can be somewhat consistent, but the clinical indicators and the condition are probably not present. So it's really difficult. It's a really difficult problem. That was Gloria Ann Bryan. Gloria Ann is an HIM coding compliance professional and leader for more than 40 years. Thanks, Gloria Ann Bryan. She was substituting for Lori Johnson.
Now you can unlock the secrets of accurate drug administration coding for the emergency department and observation services. Join subject matter expert Tiffany Bouchard as she explains how to navigate coding hierarchy with confidence. you'll be assured of precise code selection and documentation interpretation. Join the webcast, Mastering Drug Administration Coding Hierarchy. Gain insights into modifier usage and benefit from real case scenarios. Now's the perfect time to elevate your coding proficiency and safeguard your facility's revenue. Join the webcast to decode the complexities and master the art of drug administration coding. The webcast is Tuesday, May 14th. Register now to attend at the ICD University Bookstore.
Here now with the Tucked In Tuesday Report on the social determinants of health is Tiffany Ferguson. Good morning, Tiffany.
Good morning, Chuck. Good morning, all. Happy Tuesday. What I'd like to talk about is a recent report that came out from the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation Center, CMMI, as we know it collectively, released their evaluation of year 8 for the Independence at Home demonstration, known as IAH. IAH was a congressionally mandated initiative that sought to evaluate the efficacy of incentivizing home-based primary care in reducing healthcare spending and enhancing the quality of care for high-cost, high-need Medicare beneficiaries. The evaluation, obviously conducted over multiple years, has provided valuable insights. However, there obviously this went through the COVID-19 pandemic, so I thought I'd share some of the details about this demonstration. The IAH initiative commenced in 2012 with 18 participating practices, signed at testing whether at payment incentives could drive improvements in healthcare outcomes. Over subsequent years, the number of participating practices actually decreased, with only 7 practices remaining by year 8. Most of this was amidst the challenges posed by the pandemic for in-home services. Some of the decline in participating primary care clinics is attributed to the program's strict requirements, such as being available for primary care home visits at all hours pending patient needs. The requirement to achieve success in cost reduction at least 1 in 3 consecutive years. The beneficiary requirements included Medicare fee-for-service patients have at least 2 chronic conditions, require assistance with at least 2 activities of ADLs, and have been hospitalized or received acute or subacute rehabilitation services in the prior 12 months to the program enrollment. Beneficiaries must also have not been in long-term care or hospice at the time of the enrollment demonstration. So the evaluation focused on the effects of IAH on total Medicare spend per beneficiary per month and other relevant outcomes such as number of ambulatory visits compared to acute care services that members received during the demonstration period. And year 8, although there was potential reduction in total spend, it was not statistically significant. These incentive programs made to IAH practices actually exceeded the estimated spending reduction, raising question about cost effectiveness for the program overall. That's my question. The report noted that while IAH beneficiaries experienced 16% more ambulatory visits compared to their counterparts, primary care remained the central service to those delivery needs. However, the results were mixed because inpatient spending, although inpatient spending was down, hospital admissions were actually up in year 8, as were readmissions. So although I'm wondering if those were other encounters or just less acuity. What they found was that the initiative may seem theoretically appropriate to enhance patient-PCP relationship. The sole mechanism of home-based services did not yield significant results, especially during the pandemic. In addition, this is likely almost difficult to impossible to scale with the already known shortages to primary care physicians, the efficiencies we've already learned from telemedicine, which can be provided, but are outside this model expectations. Additionally, the role of extenders in home support for chronic care management, community health workers, home health services, I could go on with that. And to alleviate those chronic conditions other than pulling the primary care provider out of the clinic for home-based services. And with that, I'll send it back to you, Erica.
Thanks, Tiffany. That was Tiffany Ferguson. Tiffany is CEO for Phoenix Medical Management. Chuck?
Thanks, Erica, and thank you again, Tiffany Ferguson. And you can read Tiffany's outstanding article on this very important topic in today's ICD-10 monitor. As you heard us mention at the top of the broadcast, senior healthcare consultant Matt Bridge is with us today. Matt's going to report on how healthcare providers must modernize their approach to patient access. Here now is Matt Bridge. Good morning, Matt.
Thank you, Chuck. Happy to be here today. We'll be focusing on patient access, as Chuck mentioned, and to set the stage for this brief overview, right? Outdated patient access and financial clearance approaches negatively impact not only the financials of an organization, but also the patient experience. You know, and as healthcare is becoming more and more consumer-minded market, streamlining those processes is crucial to secure the patient financially and also provide timely access to care. Three benefits of an efficient patient access operation include financially securing net revenue prior to service, so protecting the revenue you're rightfully owed, accelerating that revenue by reducing payment delays, denials, and rescheduled appointments, and improving the patient satisfaction, as well as reducing patient leakage outside of your organization. At AGS Health, we like to look at six key strategies to improve your patient access operation. First, defining a clear strategy, right? Aligning processes with organizational goals, defining KPIs, understanding the benchmarks and how to measure success, and clarifying roles and responsibilities for all of your patient access team members. Second, it's technology, right? And investing in the right technology. So utilizing EHRs, PM systems, patient portals, digital tools, and also automation where possible to reduce manual intervention required and also reduce errors. Step three, when the technology is in place, is standardizing the processes, right? Ensuring consistent productivity and error reduction as well. Outlining workflows and expectations for team members, and facilitating future process changes and optimizations. It's critical there's clear alignment between processes and technology. Our fourth pillar is training and educating your staff. So providing comprehensive training on the tool, the technology tools, SOPs, also education on regulatory changes and compliance, as well as changes to your managed care contracts that could impact the financial clearance processes, and ensuring your staff are competent and adaptable to an ever-changing environment. Step five is measuring and monitoring performance, right? So as we talked about in step one strategy, establishing those metrics such as wait time, patient satisfaction, financially cleared days out, right? Regularly tracking your performance against benchmarks, both industry benchmarks and those that are more specific to your organization, and identifying improvement opportunities and plans where you are not consistently meeting and exceeding benchmarks. The sixth and final stage is fostering a patient-centric culture. So training your staff to prioritize those patient needs, particularly in a decentralized environment where you may have a registrar performing patient access functions while also performing patient intake. Soliciting patient feedback for continuous improvement and ensuring that you're enhancing patient satisfaction and loyalty. At AGS Health, we have a brief success story here with one of our clients, US radiology specialists. They implemented our intelligent authorization tool to automate the prior authorization process, as well as insurance verification and out-of-pocket estimates. As a result of this automation tool, daily staff productivity has doubled and manual intervention has significantly reduced, which has also resulted in improved quality. Lastly, improved authorization lead time has occurred from 3 days out to 9 days out, which really mitigates any net revenue risk to the organization as a result of unfinancially cleared patients. In conclusion, effective patient access requires strategy, technology, standardization, training, performance monitoring, and patient centricity. These best practices optimize operations, increase your revenue, reduce denials, and of utmost importance, enhance your patient experience. Thank you. And back to Erica.
That was fascinating. Thanks, Matt. That was Matt Bridge. Matt is the Senior Vice President of AGS Health.
Once again, here's Dr. Erica Reamer with her very popular segment. It's called Talk Back, Dr. Reamer. It's all yours.
Thanks, Chuck. I want to answer a few outstanding questions from my NPAC talk. Two of them are related. Our health system has chosen to use SEP2 as our criteria. Are we wrong? And why not use severe sepsis if it's on the list of CMS-approved codes and there's a recognized definition? For a more expanded explanation, please check out my article on ICD-10monitor.com. SEP1 is the terminology that indicates the severe sepsis and septic shock management bundle, which is the National Quality Forum sepsis quality measure that CMS uses. Its aim is to standardize sepsis treatment to reduce morbidity and mortality from the condition, SEP1. In the 1990s, medical groups came together to define the condition of sepsis and operationalize its treatment. Sepsis 2 was essentially defined as a presumed or confirmed infection with some of the general systemic inflammatory response syndrome, or SIRS, criteria, which were ubiquitously collected in all patients in whom the diagnosis was being considered. So these were fever or hypothermia, tachycardia, tachypnea, and elevated or low white blood cell count. Eventually, it was recognized that this cast too wide a net. In 2016, the third international consensus definitions for sepsis and septic shock, sepsis 3, was rolled out. The definition was established as life-threatening organ dysfunction caused by a dysregulated host response to infection. SIRS was out as the herald of sepsis, and the presence of organ dysfunction became the critical ingredient. In sepsis 2, there were three buckets: sepsis, severe sepsis, which was sepsis with organ dysfunction, and septic shock, which was severe sepsis with hypotension not reversed with fluid resuscitation. ICD-10-CM has codes to indicate all three. Sepsis 3 contracted the buckets to two. Sepsis, which I refer to as the condition formerly known as severe sepsis, which included organ dysfunction, and septic shock. ICD-10-CM did not change the coding schema. As a result, all sepsis now should have a code for the sepsis, another code indicating the presence of organ dysfunction with or without shock, and additional codes for the causative infection and the resultant organ dysfunction. SIRS is still useful as an alert, but SIRS does not establish sepsis. Many providers are resistant to change and cling to SIRS. I am supportive of using SIRS to identify patients who might have sepsis, but I strongly caution against using it as the sole diagnostic criteria. If you do, you will end up with patients who are erroneously assigned a sepsis DRG, and you will have to deal with clinical validation denials on the back end. Not only that, but the Office of Inspector General, or OIG, has added Medicare inpatient hospital billing for sepsis to their work plan. In my opinion, it is past time to transition to sepsis 3. Why shouldn't the providers use the expression severe sepsis? I don't believe clinicians should alter their practice of medicine just to satisfy coding. They may need to include some antiquated terminology, however, for the coders to compliantly capture legitimate conditions. Fortunately, there is coding guidance which instructs coders that if providers diagnose sepsis with related organ dysfunction, the coder may compliantly pick up R65.20, severe sepsis without septic shock, without the doctor using the obsolete qualifier severe. See my article for my suggested macro. The last question was, how do you message the importance of thorough and complete documentation when physicians, providers, are thinking the E&M 2023 changes have now relieved them of note bloat? Documentation is not just for billing. Thorough and, as Glorianne said, thorough and complete documentation is important to tell the story of the patient encounter. The professional fee evaluation and management changes in 2023, when inpatient and observation hospital care merged, and are only based on medical decision-making, MDM, or time now, should reduce note bloat. Medically appropriate history and physicals, No more gratuitous review of systems. No recurring embedding of images. Limiting copy and paste. Should reduce note bloat. Providers should streamline the documentation to make it really count. See my article for examples. It is crucial not to buy into the documentation is an unwanted burden on the provider nonsense. Documentation is part of the process of delivering quality medical care to the patient and enabling others to recognize it. If providers put mentation back into their documentation, the medical record and the patient will be better off for it. And with that, Chuck, back to you.
Thanks, Erica, very much. And folks, that is going to be a wrap for this, our 596th live edition of Talked In Tuesday. I want to thank our panelists today, Gloria Ann Bryan, Tiffany Ferguson, Tim Powell, Matt Bridge, who reported our lead story, and a very special thank you to my co-host, Dr. Erica Reamer. Until we meet again, I'm Chuck Buck, reporting for Talked In Tuesday and ICD-10 Monitor. Have a great week, everybody.
Talked In Tuesday is a production of ICD-10 Monitor.